2905. And we'll hear from you, Ms. Engel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Sydney Engel, on behalf of Appellant Derek Polk, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The Fourth Amendment forbids generalized searches. The FBI violated that guarantee when it searched the safe deposit boxes of 700 people, including Mr. Polk, without individualized suspicion as to any one of them. The government calls this an inventory search, but the Supreme Court and appellate courts have never extended the inventory search exception beyond impounded cars and arrestees, let alone to permit officers to seek out and search 700 safe deposit boxes that it obtained during a criminal investigation. Even if the exception could apply, the FBI defied its clear terms. It wrote targeted procedures to perform additional suspicionless searches on each of the boxes. The FBI also exceeded the scope of its warrants. Those warrants authorized only a limited inspection of the boxes to identify their owners and prohibited any criminal investigation of their contents. Nonetheless, the FBI searched Mr. Polk's box even after finding his contact information, and it subjected the contents of his box to an investigatory dog sniff that the warrants plainly forbade. The Ninth Circuit examined the same raid and unanimously held that these searches violated the Constitution. This court should reach the same result.
Let's unpack some of the points you just made. One is as to the scope of the warrant. And while the warrant includes the language about the search for information about owners, it also makes reference to the other requirements for an inventory search, including protecting the property, protecting the agencies, and that appears at the affidavits as well. So while there is also provision for a search for ownership information, why should we read it as limited to that rather than authorizing an inventory search consistent with the purposes of an inventory search and consistent with the guidelines that themselves also lay out the requirements for an inventory search?
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is that those statements in the affidavit and the warrant that you mentioned are general goals that are consistent with the more limited purpose identified in the warrants to identify ownership and notify the owners. The only actions, the only verbs that the warrants expressly assigned to the FBI with respect to the boxes are to inspect them, to identify ownership, and to notify their owners. And those two steps are consistent with those broader purposes of the inventory rationale to protect agencies, to ensure no hazardous items. So we think that those general goals alone do not extend the warrant beyond the clear steps that were authorized within it. The second is that although these affidavits mention those general goals, as you stated, and reference written inventory policies generally, those policies are not named, they're not further described, and they're not attached to the warrants. As this court said in Doe v. Grudy, you cannot look to unincorporated, unattached documents not attached to the affidavit to expand the scope of the search. And that's what would happen here if this court looked to the DIOG, the supplemental instructions, to expand the warrant beyond the very limited steps it authorized to identify ownership.
So the warrant says that agents have to follow their written inventory policies to protect the agencies from claims of theft or damage, and also to ensure that no hazardous items are unknowingly stored in a dangerous manner. So even if, and so explicit reference to hazardous items seems to contemplate opening the boxes at least to take a glance inside at whether there's something that's going to, you know, explode or something, leak. You know, so if they're able to do that, then why is that not enough?
We don't think that's enough, Your Honor, because the affidavits provide no specific steps expressly authorizing the FBI agents to open the boxes and inspect the contents to identify hazardous items. We read that language on Appendix 347 to just state a general goal supporting the FBI's limited authorization to identify ownership here. Well,
that all seems to be describing written inventory policies, right? The purposes of written inventory policies?
Those justifications have been associated with written inventory policies, but we don't think that they're exclusive to them. We think that's consistent with a limited authorization to identify ownership. By identifying owners and being able to return those boxes to the rightful owners, that is, in a sense, protecting these FBI agents from any hazardous materials by ensuring that they are not in possession of these boxes any longer than necessary. I will say, Your Honors, the other limitation that we see in the warrant that we think does a considerable amount of work in this case, even if you don't agree with us on our reading of the limited inspection to identify ownership, is the clear language in the warrant on page 242 of the appendix that expressly prohibits the FBI from conducting a criminal search or seizure of the contents of the box. So even if you think, based on the language we've just been discussing, that the FBI was authorized to perform at most an inventory search, this language further restricts the FBI and tells them they cannot perform any criminal investigation, and they did perform a criminal investigation when they ran the contents of Mr. Polk's box by a drug dog.
Also, we have the Supreme Court telling us repeatedly that a dog sniff is so unintrusive, at least as to things like luggage or an automobile, that it doesn't even qualify as a search.
Whether a dog sniff is a search under the Fourth Amendment and whether it is an independent Fourth Amendment violation is ultimately, we think, beside the point in this case. We're focused on the antecedent constitutional violation when the FBI unlawfully opened these safe deposit boxes. As they wrote these supplemental instructions that directed the FBI agents to take the investigatory step of running a dog sniff, they take themselves out of the inventory search exception. They have no lawful rights in these boxes. As the Supreme Court has said multiple times, and this is in place, Your Honor, and as well in Rodriguez, dog sniffs are investigative procedures aimed at detecting evidence of criminal wrongdoing. I think—
Let me just make sure I'm understanding the record correctly, because I thought the protocol was that the boxes were already opened, the cash was already out, and that's when the dog sniff occurred.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor, that that's the sequence of events. But the government can't manufacture an unlawful search to put cash in plain view for a dog sniff. It only had authority to open these boxes if it was properly exercising an inventory function.
So up until the point of a dog sniff, why wasn't it exercising a proper inventory function?
Because, Your Honor, it promulgated these supplemental instructions only 5 days before seeking a warrant in this case. And by the way, it never showed the magistrate these supplemental instructions. These supplemental instructions prescribed additional procedures for the FBI officers above and beyond the standard inventory policy in the DIOG. And significantly, these supplemental instructions directed the officers to take the investigatory step of running each of these 5,000 plus bundles of cash by a drug dog. And as the Supreme Court has said multiple times since it first established this exception 50 years ago, each of the procedures in an inventory search must be designed to produce an inventory. They must be limited in scope necessary for serving the inventory function. The dog sniff doesn't serve any of those inventory functions.
Are you saying that the promulgation of the supplemental protocol regarding the dog sniff was a constitutional violation, even if the dog sniff itself was not?
Correct, Your Honor. There can be two separate constitutional violations in play in any case, and in this case, we're saying that even if the dog sniff isn't its own constitutional violation, it was a constitutional violation to open those boxes in the first place. I actually think that the facts of place are a good illustration of the type of argument that we're making. In place, the Supreme Court said, dog sniffs are sui generis, not on their own an independent Fourth Amendment violation, but that ultimately doesn't matter because the luggage in that case was unlawfully seized, and so we need to suppress evidence of the dog sniff that resulted from that unlawful seizure, even if it itself not an independent Fourth Amendment violation. And I think that's why you see, Your Honors, several separate writings in that case saying the court didn't even need to address whether the dog sniff was itself a sui generis non-Fourth Amendment search. That was beside the point, and so it is here.
So the analogy here would be that the opening the box, even aside from the dog sniff, so they would have opened the box if it didn't have the supplemental instructions, right? Do you agree with that?
They would, of course, assuming that the inventory search exception can even open this context.
Right, okay, so they thought they, well, there's a reading of the warrant that allows them to inventory the contents of the box. So so that the following the warrant in that way was unconstitutional because there would be a subsequent dog sniff. Is that right?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. If the FBI truly wanted to conduct an inventory search, again, assuming we're in the world where inventory searches can apply in this context, then it had exactly the set of requirements and rules that it needed to follow laid out by this court countless times since Opperman.
Isn't that where Castro comes into play? I mean, why would we be looking to define the subjective intentions of the officers when they are objectively authorized to conduct an inventory search by the terms of the warrant?
We are not looking at, in this case, the subjective intentions of the officers, Your Honor, because unlike Castro, we are in a world where the FBI is following non-standard investigatory procedures. We don't think that you can divorce the DIOG inventory policies from the supplemental instructions. When the FBI walked into U.S. private vaults, it had in its hand the inventory search policy plus the supplemental instructions that directed the FBI agents what to do. And so when the FBI implemented these supplemental instructions, when they wrote them, created them, implemented them, directing the agents to expose cash to a drug dog, they were no longer preparing to, and in fact were not, conducting an inventory search. And so unlike in Castro, we can point to specific non-inventory investigatory procedures where we don't have to guess about subjective intentions. We know the FBI agents were not conducting a true inventory consistent with the exception over the past 50 years.
You agree under the case law that even if an investigatory motive is one of the reasons for the search, as long as there is a legitimate inventory purpose as well, that it stands under the Fourth Amendment, right?
Correct, Your Honor, that when the officers are following standard inventory procedures, all of the procedures that they follow must be standard in inventory, then in many cases we do not look to the subjective motive of the officers, and that's the Castro case. But here, because of these supplemental instructions, we think we're in an entirely different world.
Let me ask you about the supplemental instructions, because the DOJ provides very general guidance. And there's also operating procedures that they developed. Why aren't the supplemental instructions simply in the nature of how to conduct the particular operation? They're not consistent with anything in the DOIG, right? They just provide additional constraints on the discretion of the officers. Isn't that actually the purpose of having guidelines of an inventory on an inventory search at all? Making sure that it's consistent across all of the officers, all of the boxes that they're handling.
Discretion isn't the end-all be-all, Your Honor, and when we're talking about limiting discretion, we are talking about limiting discretion not only within a search, but across searches, and that discretion must be limited to performing inventory procedures. And so our real problem here with the search is that even if you are able to say that the supplemental instructions constrained the officer's discretion, it did so by directing them to perform a non-inventory investigatory procedure of running the cash by a drug dog, and that takes you out of the exception, discretion aside.
What is the authority that any guidelines as to conducting the inventory search need to be consistent across all searches? In other words, that it needs to pre-exist not simply the decision to engage in this search, but all searches.
I think Opperman said best, Your Honor, but of course, every subsequent case, Lafayette, Wells, Bertin have reiterated the same point. But Opperman says that standard procedure, that's the word they use, and we take standard to mean consistent across multiple searches. I see my time is out. Do you mind if I finish? And Opperman explains that these standard procedures that run across searches are a factor that tends to ensure an intrusion is going to be limited just to the caretaking function, non-investigatory, because it means that these procedures are written under a veil of ignorance, where the FBI agents, the officers, they do not know the target of the search, they do not know the context of the search. All they're doing is drafting general procedures that will apply in any run-of-the-mill situation. I think that's why in Opperman and Lafayette, you see these inventory procedures propping up and the sort of recurring routine day-to-day circumstances of impounding cars, arresting subjects. Officers need in those situations to be able to have standard policies that they can pull on. That's a very poor fit for a situation like this, where the FBI agents crafted a criminal investigation of USPV, and then they specifically designed the supplemental policy that facilitated 700 additional searches on top of that.
Let's add on 5 minutes for both sides, because we haven't gotten to the question of inevitable discovery. These thorny issues around whether this constituted an inventory search or not may be for naught if inevitable discovery as an exception applies here. Why doesn't it?
It does apply, Your Honor. The government has not carried its high burden. This court has expressly described it as a high burden in U.S. v. Alexander to identify routine procedures that the police would have followed, capable of historical verification, this language is from Vasquez, Dureyes, and Nix, that would have inevitably led the police officers to that cache and to a drug alert. Instead, the government has offered only unsubstantiated assumptions and speculations about what would have led it there. And in the language of this court and the Supreme Court, that's not sufficient. I mean, take some of the assumptions that they're asking you to make in the three scenarios that they identify in their brief. First, they ask you to assume, without any evidence, that Mr. Polk's statement to count the cash would have been interpreted as consent and is consent.
Well, let's put aside consent as a different exception. There are a number of facts that seem to be separate from the dog sniff, including that he came forward, identified himself as the owner of one of the boxes, a location that was under investigation and already charged, that he provided false numbers for those boxes, that they ran a background check and identified his prior convictions, contacted the probation officer, were told that he had reported being homeless and having no job, whereas records indicated he was spending tens of thousands of dollars on luxury items like jewelry. And then there's the parallel investigation that was out of Western District, Pennsylvania, that involved a wiretap. Are any of those facts are those themselves tainted? And if so, which ones?
The wiretap, Your Honor, is, we think, especially tainted in this regard, because each of the statements that the government identifies in their brief that Mr. Polk stated about the seizure of his cash, and the government attempts to use those statements, Your Honors, to show that the FBI would have traced back to his box anyway. Each of those statements was made after the actual seizure of the cash in this case. And as this court said in Vasquez Dureyes, if the conditions under which a statement is made should change, there can be no assurance, it's a direct quote, the statement would be the same. And so we think that the government cannot rely on those at all.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. I wasn't referring to the recording, the jailhouse recording. I was referring to the wiretap investigation with the transcripts of calls in which he was engaging.
Correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that investigation separate and apart from California investigation?
It was separate, Your Honor, but those wiretaps that the government cites in their brief, the statements that Mr. Polk made on those wiretaps, that the government attempts to marshal to show inevitable discovery were statements about the FBI searching and seizing the $400,000 in his box. And our argument is that if we are in this counterfactual world where the FBI did not search and seize Mr. Polk's cash in violation of the Constitution, we can't say for sure that he would have made those same statements that would have connected him to that box through the investigation. And the government makes no argument, and again, it's their burden to make the argument, to make no argument and point to no historical verifiable evidence that any other statements Mr. Polk made during the course of that Western District of Pennsylvania investigation would have themselves been able to support probable cause to search and seize his safe deposit box.
Okay. Thank you. We'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
AUSA Donovan Kokas on behalf of the United States. I want to spend a minute just talking about the preservation issues, and just for the benefit of anybody listening, I'm not talking about Covington and Burling or Miss Engel. They parachuted into kind of a preservational mess. In appellate waiver in this case, Mr. Polk reserved the right to appeal the issue and arguments raised in three pleadings. The issue he raised was the identical to the issue that the SNITCO civil plaintiffs raised, which was, is the inventory search illegal? So the issue's the same, but this court in Joseph said issues aren't arguments. Arguments are what people preserve. And the SNITCO civil plaintiffs argued that the entire procedure was infirm. They attacked the procedure itself. And so they attacked the DIOG and the supplemental instructions. Mr. Polk never attacked those two. He cited each of them exactly one time in his pleadings and in during argument in the district court. And instead, what he did was he attacked the execution of those procedures as to him. I submit those are drastically different arguments. The Joseph case says that for an argument to be the same, the standard is exacting. In his reply brief, Mr. Polk has just said, well, you know, I argued about this violates the Fourth Amendment and argued that probable cause was lacking to open my box. That's all true, but those aren't the same arguments.
But why shouldn't we hold the government to the contract that it entered with Mr. Polk that he was preserving not only the arguments, but also the broader issue?
Well, he's preserved the issue, but the issue, according to Joseph anyway, the issue is just what you want the district court to do. The arguments are why legally and factually you want them to do it. The issue by itself doesn't get him anywhere. Yeah, he's preserved the issue that the inventory was illegal as to his box. But that's what his arguments were, you should not have opened my box because my identifying information was on the outside. That was strictly what he argued below.
Notwithstanding Joseph, I mean, Joseph is about preservation outside of the context of an appellate waiver, right? So a contract, right? And so here we have the parties agreeing to the language that could be read to say that anything within the suppression issue is preserved for.
I would say, yes, it could have been read that way if it wasn't followed by issue and arguments raised. If we just said you preserve the issue, then I would agree with Your Honor. We might have said it's wide open, anything goes. But that plus the fact that he cited just three pleadings, that tells you he's preserved what he's trying to preserve, and what Joseph says is the only thing parties preserve is the arguments. So let's assume there's no appellate waiver involved. He still got to get past the SOC criteria because he still hasn't made the argument below. And so he's still got to show good cause for a failure to raise them or raising them belatedly. And his reply brief doesn't even mention SOC. As to, if I could talk briefly about the SNITCO, or in case you do reach SNITCO, I mean, two overarching issues that I want to sharpen up a little bit. One is the main holding was that the supplemental instructions rendered the entire inventory infirm because the SNITCO says correctly the instructions have to pre-exist the search. And then it says, and those instructions have to be generally applicable across all inventories. It actually says that. Well, my problem is twofold. One is these instructions did precede the search. They preceded the seizure. They preceded even the warrant for the seizure and the inventory. The only thing they didn't precede were the DIOG, of course, and they didn't precede the indictment. Now, SNITCO's issue seemed to be, well, these are bespoke instructions, but my response to that is the first time for everything, but there isn't always a second time for everything. And in this particular case, this was the first time the FBI had ever had to seize and inventory a bunch of safe deposit boxes en masse, because in most states, it's not legal to even offer safe deposit boxes privately outside of an FDIC institution. So they were on uncharted territory here, and they created those instructions ahead of time. Now,
so if there's going to be some modification or supplement to the DOIG, why not include that with the warrant application?
And I don't know why they did, Your Honor. I think that would have been the safer thing for sure. I think what their view was, this is consistent with the DOIG, and no one's pointed out any inconsistency even now. And so I just think it didn't occur to them to think about that. And anyway, when the court authorized the inventory, it said follow agency policies. That includes the DOIG. It includes the supplemental instructions, whether it knew about them or not.
What confidence can we have that had the magistrate received an application that included it would be conducting an inventory search only for the purpose of identifying owners, a supplement that said that there was going to be a dog sniff as part of that, that the magistrate would have authorized that warrant?
Well, because for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. One is the language in the warrant itself is the Opperman community caretaking language. But Opperman itself says the investigation just can't be the sole purpose of the inventory. And page 153 of the supplemental appendix, that's echoed in the DIOG. And then that even contemplates right there in the policy that the magistrate knew about. It says non-inventory searches can proceed contemporaneous with the inventory search, and all that has to happen is that they be documented. Now, it's risky to do that because you run the risk that later on a court might find that one little thing you did, like a dog search, rendered the entire inventory suspect. But not even SNCCO held that. None of the judges held that. And I'd submit that the fact that of the 700 boxes that contain something, we returned the contents of around 500 boxes to people, no problem, pursuant to this inventory. That, I think, speaks volumes about whether this was at least, if not entirely, at least almost entirely for purposes of this inventory.
Does it change the legitimacy of the inventory search that this wasn't a matter of sort of evolution of identifying something in plain view in the course of conducting the inventory search, of opening the boxes and itemizing what's in there, that in writing ahead of time, the government had laid out its intention to conduct a dog sniff?
No, Your Honor, and I would say maybe your scenario might make it even worse for us, because remember what Wells says is what we fear is uncanalized discretion by the agents. Here, the inventory search says, it looks like cash, the supplemental procedures say, if it looks like cash exceeding more than $5,000, submit a dog sniff if available. If not, or if it's other kinds of valuables, you don't do that. So there's no, any subjective motives of the agents don't come into play. It's just, that looks like more than $5,000. This was almost $400,000. The agents submit it to the dog sniff, and the dog detects what it detects or doesn't.
You agree that the dog sniff was not for purposes of safety?
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, I can explain to you how I arrived at that if you want. It's essentially that when I looked, remember, we didn't raise this argument, the district court tumbled to it. But when I looked at it, I thought, well, okay, then the agents must have shown the dogs the money, the dog the money before the agents interacted with it. That didn't happen.
Right.
Agents aren't wearing masks. There's no provision for what would happen if the dog sniffs the money and falls over.
Your time is limited. I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
So with that point conceded by the government,
yeah,
and was not for purposes of safety, how was the inclusion of a dog sniff as part of the supplemental instructions? How did that further either of the other purposes? How does it further either of the other purposes of an inventory search?
It doesn't. So this is one of those pure, you know, it is the first of all, the inventory is done by this time, right? By the time it's shown to the dog, the inventory is complete. Everything's written down, video recorded. This is the last thing that happens before the money goes off. It doesn't further any of those purposes, but my response is it doesn't have to under the DIOG, because the DIOG says the sole purpose of the inventory can't be investigatory. This dog sniff is one tiny facet that didn't even apply to all kinds of evidence. And what I would characterize this as is also consistent with DIOG, which the magistrate judge told us to follow. It is a non-inventory search that all we had to do was do it and document what we found, and we did that. So it doesn't, unless your honors are prepared to find that the inclusion of the canine sniff rendered the entire inventory either in bad faith or solely for the purpose of criminal investigation, I don't know how it, any other way than just to be upheld under the Opperman line of cases. Okay. The other aspect of SNITCO on its primary holding is that, well, an inventory has to be applicable across all kinds of inventories, and that just isn't the case. I mean, we have different inventory procedures law enforcement does for firearms, for explosives, for, you know, land vehicles, water vehicles, air vehicles. Even, you know, in Maryland v. King, as I think about it, this is, I think, 2013, the Supreme Court upheld what amounted to a genetic inventory of an arrestee pursuant to a lawful seizure of a person. It held it was okay to do the buccal swab. Now, to my mind, although it didn't characterize this, I don't think, as an inventory search or even an administrative search, in my mind, it's hard to imagine something more private than the inside of your body, but the Supreme Court has said, well, a standard procedure allows you to do it if the seizure itself is lawful. And it's the same thing we have here, so except the difference is instead of the inside of someone's body, it's a safe deposit box with valuables in it that Mr. Polk left with a third party. It's a little hard to argue that takes the place of a home or something of that caliber.
Can you spend some time talking to us about inevitable discovery?
Yes.
And is that other evidence, as your colleague was just arguing, is that evidence also tainted?
Well, I don't know. It's not also tainted. So here's the thing I think we need to take a step back and recognize. And I don't understand counsel to be asserting this now, but no one's ever asserted that the actual seizure was improper. So because of that puts us in a very unusually good, for me, case for inevitable discovery, because usually what happens is there's some debate about, well, would the contraband have still been there by the time you got around to getting a warrant and going? And we don't have that problem because if you presuppose the FBI didn't open his box, wouldn't open his box, the FBI still would have had his box, and it would have
How
had
long?
It.
I mean, they were intending to return the property of the box owners.
Exactly, and Your Honor, like, that actually sharpens the first point that I made on inevitable discovery, and let me get to that right now then. So you remember the first point I made involves just the phone call between Agent Versosa and Mr. Polk, and what's precipitated that is on March 26th of 2021, Mr. Polk has filed a motion for return of property on the FBI's website. The agent calls him to ascertain whether he's entitled to return of this property. And that's when there's the wrong box numbers, and Polk says there's cash, and he says count it. Now, I know Mr. Polk has said, well, the count it thing was sort of an offhand comment, but remember, this is in the context of him asking for return of his property, which brings this case right in line with the Frank case that I cited in the brief. And in that case, at pages 1004 and 5, it was a similar situation. Defendant had been arrested. The police had seized a third-party container. In that case, it was a rental car that had his property in it. And the defendant said, I want my property out of that rental car. Now, the police can't just hand him back the rental car. As soon as he asks for his property back, they're allowed to go into the rental car to get his property, and they see what they see.
I think we don't have any findings of fact that really address the context in which he said count it, the tone, you know, if really should be considered a statement of consent. So let's sort of skip over count it if we can.
Okay. What I would like to mention about this is the reason we don't have those findings of fact is Mr. Polk's counsel in the district court waived the right to examine these witnesses. At page 116 of the appendix, he said, I want an evidentiary hearing. This is the motion to suppress, where I will examine the agents who drafted the warrants. Those agents are from California, Versosa and Zellhart. We make those two agents available to him in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, On the day of the hearing, page 539 of the appendix, he comes back and says, Your Honor, I just read all the papers last night and I realize I don't need to examine these agents. I have everything I need based on the papers. So he's hardly in a position now, as he is in his reply brief saying, let's have a remand for an evidentiary hearing. He's not in a position to do that. He had the chance to develop this by putting those agents on.
We don't have a factual finding either way. We have a statement that's counted, which I think, you know, it could be read as sarcasm, as rhetorical. I mean, they're or consent, right? And we don't have a district court saying this is what it was, as a matter of fact. So that we don't have anything upon which to say this was consent. And look, if it was consent, then that's the game's over anyway. And why do we have
You're
these
right.
other issues?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. So let's suppose he never says count it. We're still within Frank. And the Frank case says when someone asks for a return of their property that's inside a third party's container, police can go into that container. It doesn't matter how forcefully they say, it doesn't matter whether they voice it as a command or whatever. And Frank said that's not a Fourth Amendment issue. It's not even an inventory issue at that point. The police are just doing what you ask them to do to get your property back to you. So that goes to the first point, I think. And then, you know, all the subsequent points come off of that a little bit, although I think I presupposed in the second two that the agent didn't open the box pursuant to Mr. Polk's command. But the other factor that we have here for inevitable discovery that we almost never have, in addition to the fact that the property would still be there, is the fact that we have this parallel investigation where Mr. Polk is making these comments. But Mr. Polk only knows that we seized his property. That much is clear, because the indictment, the affidavit in the indictment is not sealed until August of 2021. So what he knows is what's publicly released was that we seized the safe deposit boxes at USPB. So he's upset that he knows we have his money, and he's talking about his money on these phone calls in the context of his drug dealing.
And at that point, the government had seized all the boxes, and had it returned the property to any box owners?
It had not. So I don't want to say at that point it had returned the property, because it took months sometimes. But it was in the process of returning property to people who requested it, yes.
So where in the record do we know that he could not have had his property returned by the time the government got the...
That he couldn't have had his property returned. So, okay, well, that's where you have to remember the whole rest of what Agent Versosa learned. So what I think Mr. was banking on was he would call, the agent wouldn't know who he was, wouldn't research who he was, wouldn't figure out his background. So Versosa learns all of that, and then on top of that, through the parallel investigation, they learn that he's, you know, dealing drugs. They're not going to just return the property to him at that point. I mean, they have enough suspicion to hold it, maybe not even for civil forfeiture, for what happened here, which was a criminal forfeiture.
The challenge here is that Versosa found out about the $399,000 and the dog alert before he investigated Polk's background. And why should we assume that he would have done all that investigation, learned about the jewelry that was purchased, you know, the address not lining up, spoke to the probation officer, all of those things, if he hadn't known that there was $400,000 in a box that had drug residue on it?
Well, I'm not sure it's clear. I know on the same day he learned that, you know, he learned about Polk's background and he learned about what was in the box. So I'm not sure one thing preceded the other necessarily. But you're right.
I think the record shows that he learned about the box search and the dog alert on April 6th, and then the next day, April 7th, he called the probation officer and, you know, got the IRS report and so on.
Yeah, I mean, well, so that would have been something for Polk to develop had he called the agents he could have done back in Johnstown, and he could have got the agent to say, "Here's all I knew. I wouldn't have opened the box if I hadn't known X and Y." And remember, I mean, his whole theory has been that the entire inventory was a ruse, and the agents were bound and determined to open his box even without probable cause.
As the agents here were identifying owners, were they routinely checking on criminal history of those owners?
So, Your Honor, I don't know if they're routinely doing that. I think most of the time, probably not. I think most of the time, if there was something innocuous in the box and it was clear it was an heirloom or something like that, probably not. I think it's when something put their antenna up, such as, you know, Polk's behavior during the phone call and, you know, picking the wrong two box numbers. if you have 400 grand in cash or any amount of cash in a box that you care enough to put in a box, you're probably going to remember the number. And then, you know, and
but there was also in the record that he had his picture taped to the top of the box and his name on it, right? And he didn't have the box number on the key. And so, you know, I mean, what? There wasn't any real argument that he was trying to evade the government knowing which box was his. He, in fact, wanted the government to know that which box was his so they could return his property.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we've ever argued that he was trying to evade or not evade. I think it seemed implausible. I would just say I think it seemed implausible to the agent that somebody's not going to know which is their box, precisely because of what you said, Your Honor. It's not on the key. So when you go to access it, you have to know.
Except you look at it and then you see your name and your picture taped.
Oh, no. It's on top of them. So these boxes slide in. The nests are essentially cabinets, and the box slide in and lock in. So it's not until you slide it out that you see your name and your picture on the box.
Okay.
Trying to think what else. Oh, I'm sorry.
At some point, we were talking about the Western District of Pennsylvania investigation and whether and how that would have relates to the inevitable discovery argument.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in this case, so assume that all that's happened is the boxes have been seized, and assume even that Mr. Polk hasn't been called. I mean, counterfactually, he was called, but assume he hasn't been called, none of that happens. What you have is these wiretaps showing that he's involved in a large-scale drug enterprise to and from, and he is complaining about the seizure of his money. He may not know yet. He doesn't know for sure how much they've got until August in that jail call, because that's when he mentions the $399. But early on, he's just mentioning that they seized his money from this box, and he's upset about that because it's hampering his drug activity. I mean, I'd submit that that's more than probable cause to, you know, not only search his apartment, which they actually did obtain a warrant to do, but also to search the box, again, presupposing that it hadn't been opened. That would be enough for a warrant because he's talking about something pretty important that he's connected to his drug dealing that's inside that box. So that's why, and I think that's maybe the second or third scenario that I kind of taped out. And again, in the district court, Ms. Polk said, the documents show you everything you need to rule in my favor on this. And in his opening brief, he just sort of said, Wong Sun in two sentences, I win. And only after I map out these three scenarios does he start asking for a remand. And my point is, this is just like the other preservation problems in this case, where we made those witnesses available to you all the way out in Johnstown, and you didn't call them.
Thank you. Ms. Engel, what's your response to the evidence of the calls where he's discussing drug trafficking and complaining about the seizure itself? Even standing alone, why isn't that sufficient for probable cause to do a search of the box, to get a warrant to do a search of the box and the home?
We don't think that's sufficient, Your Honor, because we don't think that the government can say with confidence that Mr. Polk would have made those exact statements in the counterfactual world where all the FBI did was take his box and preserve it for its eventual return.
Well, what else did Mr. Polk know at that point?
He, as the government says, the government's subsequent steps were public record, but ultimately it's on the government's burden to prove what Mr. Polk did or didn't know here for purposes of the inventory or for purposes of the inevitable discovery exception to show that the statements would inevitably have been made in the same way. And the government, we don't think, has carried its burden on that score.
Why is it enough for the government to point out that the affidavit is still sealed? There's no additional information beyond the fact of the seizure, and you're not contesting the fact of the seizure, right?
Correct, Your Honor. It's still a world that we do not know. We do not know if the FBI had conducted a proper inventory of the safe deposit boxes or no inventory at all. If Mr. Polk would have had the same sort of conversation with the agent in April. We don't know how he would have felt about that circumstance and whether he would have felt as upset and angry about it and thus made those statements. I think, as this court said in Vasquez de Reyes, that inevitable discovery is ultimately a really poor fit when what you're working with are statements made by someone under very specific contexts. It's quite a different fact pattern than Nick's, for example, where the officers in that case were able to testify and point to procedures specifically identifying the steps that they would have taken to uncover the body less than, you know, 2 or 3 hours after the defendant had revealed it himself.
What in the record indicates that Mr. Polk had any awareness that there was an inventory search at the time his calls were picked up on the wiretap?
There's nothing in the record that I can point to for that, Your Honor. Still, we think the other circumstances and context around his conversation with the agent in April and his early interactions when he walked up to U.S. private vaults the day of the raid, all of that could have materially shifted had the FBI's plans instead complied with a proper inventory procedure, which they did not.
In what way would they have changed if the FBI were not following a supplemental instruction or dog sniff?
It's entirely possible, we think, Your Honor, that the agents wouldn't have pressed on some of the same points in the conversation with Mr. Polk. They might have been less interested in his criminal history or his statement to his probation officer.
But again, if we take all of that evidence out and look only to the wiretap evidence from the separate parallel investigation in Pennsylvania, why isn't that sufficient? And what are you suggesting that something would have been different as to that evidence?
We definitely think, as we've been discussing, that we cannot count on Mr. Polk's wiretap statements being the same. As for any, if you excise the statements and look at just the other evidence that the government obtained during that Western District of Pennsylvania, the government doesn't make any argument that that extra evidence, whatever it is sufficient minus those wiretap conversations. I think it's their second retcon in the brief, relies specifically on those tap statements. They don't provide a theory of probable cause based on any other evidence obtained from that investigation. So it's not something that's in the record. They point to no verifiable facts. And again, it's their burden to lead the court to that evidence.
Okay.
I would like to make one more point, Your Honor, in my brief time. The government concedes that the dog sniff serves no inventory purpose, and we think that that is enough to resolve the inventory search exception, as we discussed earlier. The inventory search exception has always required inventory-based procedures. Once the FBI planned a search and tacked on this dog sniff, it was no longer in the world of inventory searches. The government's theory would allow any police officer across the country to, under the guise of an inventory search, tack on a criminal investigation, a dog sniff, without obtaining probable cause. If you zoom out in this case, it wasn't just Mr. Polk's box that was exposed to this criminal investigation. It was 700 boxes. And that starts to, if you don't mind if I conclude.
Please.
Thank you so much. That starts to look quite a bit like the general sweeping searches that this court or the Supreme Court was concerned about in Edmund, the drug checkpoint with a dog sniff. The Supreme Court said that's not okay. That starts to look a lot like the sort of general sweeps that Justice Souter and Justice Ginsburg were concerned about in their separate writings in Cabeas, that if we take place in Cabeas to their logical extreme, we are inviting police officers to take drug dogs to parking garages, to pedestrians on a sidewalk, and then just claim that it's not a search and nonetheless perform an investigation. And we think that's what happened. Thank you so much, Your Honors. We ask that this court reverse the denial and take. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both counsel for really superb oral argument today. And we will take this case under advisement. We will move on to